Good morning and welcome to the January 15 work session for the Board of Island County Commissioners. And the first group up today is Public Works. Good morning.
Good morning, Commissioners. James Sylvester, Assistant Director of Public Works, and is with Fred, the Director of Public Works. Today we wanted to bring before you a backhoe purchase. It's on our 2025 CIP. It was a planned purchase. The price between when it was placed on the CIP and now has gone up almost 20%, 16%.
When was it placed on the CIP?
Last year.
What time of year?
I am not 100% sure of that. I would think around budget season, but
mid to late year.
So we're ready to purchase it now. You wanted to go purchase it, and you discovered it's going to cost another $40,000 or whatever it is.
$34,000. Yeah. Well, $33,900 is the increase that we've seen. So that's our ask this morning, is that the board approve.
And where's the money coming from? Which
this will be out of solid waste.
The solid waste fund. Okay. We have to have the backhoe, correct?
Backhoe.
And we have the funding for it.
Yes.
I'm okay with consent.
Hey.
Okay.
I mean, I'd like us to get our bids nailed down a little bit better, but okay.
And then secondly, you have an add-on.
Did we negotiate it all on the price? Did we say we're over budget? Did we say, are there any features we don't need?
We did look at all those. It's basically off of a state type contract. So this is kind of the way it pre-negotiated.
Needs tires.
Got to have special tires on. Sorry.
Good. Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Okay. And Ed, you have this item number two.
Yes. Good morning, Commissioners. Ed Sylvester, County Engineer. Do have an add-on.
Mm-hmm.
We were here in December of 2023 with a request for a vacation of a small portion, basically the end of the cul-de-sac of the Lincoln Street, which is down in South Whidbey. And when we were here, we were going to go set up a public hearing. But since then, we also had to go out and get a survey of the property so we can get the proper description into the documents, things that aren't done until the board actually says, yes, we'll go through with the petition to vacate. Mm-hmm. So passage of time, we were going to just go set the public hearing. And after a year, it might be just too long of a time. So this is basically just a refresher for the board.
Okay.
Before we set the public hearing, that we agreed in 2023, December, to go forward with it. And I just wanted to show this so that it doesn't just pop up on your screen someday and you wonder what is happening down here in South Whidbey with a vacation of the end of the county road.
Can you remind me, this was a request by the property nearby, the adjacent property?
They own two parcels here. And at my mouse, this the little red section in between, it's 20 feet by 30 feet. Mm-hmm. It's between their two parcels that they own today. So it's essentially just their parking lot that they park their vehicles in. It's clear of all county drainage. We don't have anything except out in the cul-de-sac itself. So it doesn't cause any problems for us. But it was just a sliver of land that at the time that the plat was put together, it was just assigned to the county. So it will be assigned to the parcel here on the right side, the pink one. The house is actually on the left parcel, but we're assigning it to the parcel on the right just because if they do split someday in the future, both parcels would have access to the county road. So we wouldn't create a landlock.
I can see that because right now, that's the parcel on the right. That's their only access to the road.
Correct.
But there isn't any other... I'm not seeing any other value to the county or to the citizens. Anything in the future, I can't imagine at this point what else we would ever need that for.
We have a drainage easement that runs along this very thin 20-foot sliver of land that runs all the way out to the beach.
The 57605?
from one street to the other, we have our drainage easement. It runs right in this area here.
Yeah, 57605.
Correct. I'm sorry, I couldn't read the number, Commissioner. So our lines are all clear. The drainage has been in place for years, and we have no reason to ever change our drainage system. Okay. So
how is that property to the right? Where's their access point then? They'd go through that tiny little corner off Lincoln Street?
Well, we assigned the shaded area. We would assign it actually to this parcel this on parcel. The right. Okay. And the house is on the left, and their driveway is in there. So
right. So the other parcel then would access off of Lincoln. If something went wrong, there's enough room for access right there.
Correct. Correct.
And then these properties that are further down, like that R3.
Down in.
They're down to the bottom of the page.
Correct.
How are they accessing?
The ones at the bottom of the page are all accessing down on a road down to the bottom.
Oh, there's a road on the water side?
Down across the bottom side of the page, and the ones that are immediately below.
There's a road on the water side that I'm just not seeing.
Down in here, correct. It's not there.
Well, that doesn't make sense because there's not a road easement that goes through to those parcels.
That this section here also has access up this other road here. So they do have
an easement.
Correct. And that's how their accesses are. You don't see it on here, but they do have easements through here. And then that's where their existing driveways are running today.
Okay. I mean, I guess what I'm wondering, so all of these places have access points. There's nothing that's landlocked down further?
Correct.
I'm surprised because it looks like there's a whole bunch of landlocked
stuff. It does. And I want to make sure that that Lincoln Street and that whatever it's called, Dazzdale Street, were intended to go straight through.
That the existing houses, the shadowed areas are the houses today, and they all have accesses to the road system through easements.
R3, the two boxes, so if you go to the right, the white box to the right, those two boxes underneath the property that has access, those have access?
All up through this thing, through the DESL.
Okay.
Who owns the property that they have access through? So they have actual easements?
That's all in place, correct.
Okay. Okay.
And they're buying it? The property?
They have it's a small token, basically.
If they're buying
from us, correct.
We're giving it to them?
It's dedicated. It's dedicated to them. They're just paying the cost of the processing for us, our time. So there is no dollar per square foot in the calculation.
Is that the proper mode?
We're running the same fashion that we always run on the dedications and the vacations that we operate off of.
How come when I wanted to put a camera down a drainage pipe, I was told that that was gifting of public funds.
Correct.
Because it wasn't, yeah, remember you
took, I got. Oh, I remember that, yeah. Yes.
But giving away land to somebody isn't gifting of public funds?
Under the dedication and vacation processes, you're able to exchange properties as long as all the costs are paid for. So we run the tally of all of our time and all of our costs, and they have to reimburse us for that.
What are we getting?
I don't have that number with me.
No, but my staff. What are we getting in exchange?
In exchange?
You said in order to exchange property, which means that I give you something and then they give me something. So what are we getting?
That's what you just said, Ed. You did just say that.
We do get our costs recovered is what we get. Our administrative time, any time that we put in, we run that cost and we present that to them that they have to fund at the end.
Right, but we wouldn't have those costs.
Correct.
If they didn't cause us to have the costs.
Correct.
So what are we getting for giving them something? Because getting our costs recouped for something that they're costing us, that's not getting, that's recouping costs.
Well, and we also then don't worry about the maintenance piece of this anymore either, because all the land that the county owns, and there's little slivers like this all over the county that we have small wedges. but we're still responsible for them. And they come at odd times. Normally when there's a water problem or a storm that debris blows onto the road or hits somebody's house and it comes off a county property. Now this little portion of the road, it won't be that anymore. It's purely on their deeds now.
Okay, so what you're asking for us for today is to allow you to set a public hearing, correct?
Correct.
And we had indicated previously we would allow that to happen, and it just did not happen.
Correct. It was a whole year that had gone by. Okay. So we thought we'd come back and refresh.
Okay. I'm okay with us going forward and scheduling a public hearing, and we can have more in-depth conversation at that time. What's your thoughts, Commissioner?
We'll have a public hearing, but the conversation's going to go just like this.
I understand.
I don't understand how it's not gifting.
Yeah, let's make sure that we have very clear guidelines from the prosecuting attorney about gifting public funds.
We'll do.
Public property, yeah.
I don't have an issue with the vacation. I have an issue with giving somebody land. It has value.
Correct.
Right. So we're giving somebody increased value.
And they'll pay for that increased value in their taxes. They do get taxed on it.
Oh, there's that.
Yeah, everybody does. But not everybody gets free land. Okay, I'm not convinced, so let's get this figured out.
Yeah, we will.
If somebody gave you free land.
Fair market value.
Yeah.
Correct.
I don't care if it's $10. It's got land has value to it. It's valuable right to them, or they wouldn't have asked for it.
Agree.
So they shouldn't get it for free. Other people paid for their parking. Other people paid for their land. Other people paid for things. But these folks get it for free.
And I'll pull the numbers out for the public hearing.
Okay.
So that it's open, full and open.
So just don't show up and act like it's the first time you heard this question, or that's not going well.
Oh, no, no, Commissioner.
All right. Thank you very much, Ed.
Okay. Thanks, Commissioner. Thank
you. So next we have IT about a software review for PAX. That's why we have all of the PAX people in the audience.
Everybody, right?
Yeah, everyone who's part of this conversation should come up.
Morning, commissioners.
Morning.
Dean Lamborn, IT director. The IT department made an application portfolio presentation back on December 4th. Mm-hmm. And at that time, we were asked to bring in all the stakeholders for PACs to discuss our recommendation that we need to look at possibly replacing that. So we're all here today for that.
Okay.
So do you have
any this conversation?
Yeah, we don't. We're just waiting for you to talk to us.
Okay. I guess I misunderstood. I thought you would have questions for everyone.
So tell us why you want to replace PACs.
We basically came to the recommendation that we need to look at possibly replacing it because we felt the user interface is outdated. We are concerned about the level of support that we are receiving from them. At that, when we made the recommendation, we had just gone about 6 months without resolving a problem that had been affecting the treasurer through that time and had made minimal progress on resolving that. Since then, that has been resolved. We are still worried about that this application as it now exists is going to be replaced by a web version down the road. And that the time that it's going to take for them to do that is probably we're looking at least a couple of years before they're ready to do that. And whether this will remain stable in the meantime.
So I remember when PAX was first implemented. Tony might remember that. You remember that, Christina. It was a painful implementation. It was very painful. It took a long time. So I was kind of hoping that all those bugs have been worked out. And you're telling me that it's just now, at this point, it's just gotten old.
Yeah.
And it's not being maintained. And
we're concerned that they're not going to be updating it and keeping it, maintaining it. I think all their effort is going into their SAS version. Mm-hmm. And they've kind of stopped support of this, or at least reduced the support level that we've been receiving on this.
What's our backup option? I mean, I haven't heard any other counties start saying that they're using other things.
Got a list from Matt and Christina yesterday. In the state of Washington, it's about 50-50. There's about 50% that are using PACS. There's another 50% that are using Omentum. Is that the correct name?
Not Tyler.
Okay.
Not Tyler.
Tyler purchased a mine.
Tyler's the newer one. There's only one in the state that's converting. I think that's Walla Walla.
What is it that, I mean, when we first got this, it was really all about the assessor's office and the planning department. Yeah. So what is it that you want, Kevin?
So I really appreciate the forward looking of IT, and, you know, especially when it comes to software, because technology generally rapidly develops and it also gets old very quickly. The only problem I have right now is there is really no other viable alternative to what we have. So there's still counties that are converting to this product. Asotin and Grant County just converted. They were going to go to Tyler Technologies, or they got an RFP from Tyler and from Harris. Tyler was like $4 million compared to Harris at $1.1 million for them. We paid like $500,000 in 2010. Today, if we wanted to get this product, we'd probably be over $2 million.
What's our funding source for that?
Well, that's just that there, you know, it would have to come out of the county's budget. But
you think we have $2 million for a piece of software? I'm seriously asking, are you making a recommendation that we spend $2 million on a piece of software?
No, we're recommending that we plan for replacement.
This is a planning conversation. They're not telling we have to replace it.
I mean, I don't even know where we're going to get $2 million.
Well, we don't know what other states use either. I mean, you could go wide. There could be 20 products on the market. We just don't know. We haven't made any effort. And this is 20 years old. The vendor was very straightforward with us when we had the conversation with them that they are looking forward to, you know, new products in the future and changing their code base to a modular, more maintainable software. And that all sounds really promising. But if this dies next year, we don't have any planning to move forward. What do we do next?
But if other counties are just moving to it now, probably they're being assured it's not going to die next year.
And they have assured us as well. And we spent 6 months down.
Oh, we did.
The treasurer's office was in, yeah, really dire shape.
The treasurer's office or the whole system?
The treasurer's office.
Primarily some of the, you can describe.
It's mostly
tax collection.
Okay. But it does affect a website, which affects the taxpayers. But it's mainly a file that we need to move from our tax system and to create a file that we use to have an updated payment card. And it's just causing problems. We temporarily resolve the issues by just running those programs and on the weekend, but normally to make it work, we have to run it every day. It took, like about 5-6 months for them to finally tweak their system. However, they're not between IT department and the Harris Govern. They resolve the issues where I can now run that file that I can import daily to that website for taxpayers to pay their taxes quicker. We run it, and it took about 2-3 hours a night, evening, after closing. So it works. It's working now. Yeah, but it was a painful process the last 5-6 months.
Part of the problem is that you got to be very careful about which vendors you choose, because taking somebody from a company that does business in Indiana and them having to try to comport or comply with Washington state laws that are constantly evolving and changing. It's Snohomish County is in the process of converting to a new Amentum product that's not in Washington State. They said it was fully developed. They're over 3 years into their conversion. They're still not using it because it wasn't fully developed. And Snohomish County has very robust IT compared to us. They actually have people that help work on the development of that. We have none of that. And so also we're very limited in Island County because our size, a lot of vendors wouldn't, they're not going to start their Washington State product in Island County. They're going to want a big county with lots of money that's very robust. So it's, I think we're just kind of stuck with what we have now. I'm hopeful that their HGO conversion, this is PAX, they're converting to a different style of, you guys can explain the tech stuff behind it probably better. It's not what we have now. It's more, I guess, cloud-based,
yeah,
cloud-based type thing. But that conversion, it could take a couple of years, 3 years. They're going to do it in modules. I know Asotin and Grant, I think, are in because they bought this new product. And then shortly after they bought it, they found out that they're going to this HGO. So they were a little disappointed that they felt like they bought a used car. So they kind of put them in on the early stages of helping implement that. They've offered the same thing to me. If I want to get involved in that, I'm not sure I want to yet. I want to see how it goes with Grant County first. And it's our most important system in the county. We can't afford to screw it up.
So how's it working for planning at this point, Jonathan?
So we use the data that the assessors puts into PAX on a daily basis for reviewing parcels for development. Our permit techs and plans examiners and planners use it. So we're grateful to have seats on that to be able to look through that information and have that available. The only other thought I had was there's been a couple of hiccups in the past where ICGeoMap and PAX talk to each other to update information. And so of course we use ICGeoMap every single day. So we're grateful for the program to have it, but we just wanted to be here to support and don't have any.
So the commissioners are also being asked in the near future to look at another very, very expensive system, which is the replacement of our ERP, our accounting system. I can't imagine a world in which we would be able to afford to replace PAX and that system at the time, not only just the cost of it, but also just the implementation for our IT group. Imagine what a nightmare that would be. So I think that IT is going to have to think about really staging and budgeting.
Yes.
So I think that probably you're going to want to talk with Susan and kind of plan, make some long-term plan, some five-year plan or something for these large implementations of projects. Don't just bring it to our budget meeting and say we want to replace these two systems next year.
Yeah, that wasn't our plan. We just want to make sure you're aware of the situation. And this was more of a, it's not working real well. Okay. And you shouldn't be surprised by something like this.
Okay.
Now, our understanding was it was a request for information.
I'm sure it was.
And that you were hearing different things from us than from everybody else. We were supposed to be everybody in here so that we all get a chance to present our views at the same time.
So to encapsulate, tell me if I understand this correctly. All of the users of PAX are seeing the termination of PAX down the road. You're not sure?
I don't agree with that. I think I see it as, well, with the current PAX, the way it is, eventually, someday, it's going to get replaced. It's going to have to. But if there's a good evolution with their new product and a conversion with that new product, which shouldn't, it's not going to be coming to you going, we need $4 million. It's going to be converted to their new module or their modules. And then if we want additional modules, we could purchase those separately. But everything we're doing now, we should eventually be able to do in HGO in a modern way.
So, okay.
I I just think that's our only solution right now. Sorry. I just don't think there's anything else out there that we could afford. And my biggest problem with PAX, frankly, is I don't like the way it was converted from our old system in 2010.
Mm-hmm. Was that Palomino or something?
That wasn't like that. A PAX problem. That mm-hmm. was just a how they converted the data from that old system into our new system. So.
Okay. Did you have any questions?
I mean, I guess I'm trying to understand. I get that it's like a budget for the future conversation. I just want to make sure that everybody's in agreement and the software works for the users, and that we're not, just because we're concerned about a company doing the maintenance or the difficulty for IT doesn't mean that it's not the right software to be used by the departments, because it doesn't sound like there's an alternative out there right now that works. And so if there's not an alternative, then there's not a need to replace it. So that's what I'm trying to like make sure, is that what we didn't get was an IT recommendation, because this is hard for IT. IT doesn't know how to maintain the software. Okay, but this is the software that we have, the one that works, the one that we can use, and there's no other option. So you're not my primary concern in this particular conversation. My primary concern is the end users who have to have this software to do their jobs. And so we're not going to replace something until we've got something that the end users are like, okay, this is going to work for us. This is what we need. Because I literally have watched us buy software and implement software that respectfully IT's liked and the users haven't been able to use. So we're not going to do that again. One. Two, I've watched us buy software that we thought was brilliant and then it didn't work the way it was going to work, and now we've got to buy it again. And these dollar amounts are way too big. I mean, I don't even know that we'll get enough fund balance accumulation at the end of this year to have money to put aside. We spent $700,000 of fund balance for operating expenses this year. $700,000 from our savings account went to our checking account, so we could give raises and not lay people off and deliver level of service and keep things going. And well, that doesn't happen for 2 years in a row. And now we're talking about major enterprise purchases. So the things we're asking for have to be the highest priority things. I'm not saying that to be mean. I'm saying that because there's a point where 700,000 is zero, right? So when we say we need $2 million, I don't even know how we're going to save up that much. And it sounds like this one's working right now. I mean, I get that we need a plan, but I really only want a plan for things that we need and for solutions that are out there. And it doesn't sound like there's another solution out there.
So
my initial statement may have been stronger than what I meant it to be. What I meant to say is that this is an application that we think is at highest risk for failure in the next couple of years, and we should look at the possibility of replacing. We are not making a recommendation to go to one thing or other. We just felt that this is something that we need to make the commissioners aware of, and that we wanted to have other people come in and express their view on the product.
And as far as maintenance, we can maintain the database side. We can't do anything on the code side. It's compiled code, so it's not that it's hard. We just don't have access to it. It requires the vendor to respond, and the vendor has moved their resources to the new product. So all of the counties anywhere that need help on the old product share basically two people. And that's what the problem is. The vendor is no longer responsive on the old product. It's not that there's zero response. It's so slow that it's, you know, caused these treasure issues. So where we can help, we have, you know, creatively tried to work around the vendor, but we just don't have access to their compiled code.
Can you buy that? Like if it's something they're phasing out, can you buy the old code I don't.
You would have to buy people to maintain it too, so it wouldn't be a smart investment. It would cost more than doing the other, not desirable option.
We do have annual PAX user group meetings that we just started last year, where all of our PAX users get together as a group. And that's been real helpful because everybody shares some of the same frustrations with any software vendor. But that gives us the ability to kind of unite as a group and say, these are our big issues that we want you to try to solve, PAX. Well, otherwise, we're gonna all go somewhere else.
That sounds like a really cool club. I can't believe I haven't been invited to attend.
There's one in Bellingham this year.
On the list that you gave us of all the high-risk softwares, is that ranked out for us, or it's just, are you going to rank that out? Like, if this is the highest risk one, then we're not going to talk about enterprise content management, or we're not going to talk about the accounting software, are we ranking this out in terms of urgency?
If we wanted to rank it in terms of risk, the biggest risk is WinCams, which is used by public works and facilities. Mm-hmm. Those are stuff that we are in the process of replacing. Okay. This is the next biggest risk as far as what we've seen in the terms of being able to continue supporting this.
Mm-hmm. So we haven't been working on the accounting system because there's another committee doing that right now, right? I could be
right. No, there. Well, I thought you were on that committee. No. So, okay. So, yes, there's a group working on that. But I mean, I guess what the board's going to need to know are highest needs and priorities. I mean, we're going to need that.
Yeah.
I mean, from a risk standpoint, from a number of users standpoint.
The last pages of the presentation, I know it was a while ago, ranked highest, medium, and low.
Yeah.
And so there were only two in the high, packs and cams. And so there's a chunk of stuff in medium. And if you want to talk about that and have a dive back, we could.
I just don't want the medium to get ahead of the high.
No, I agree.
Yeah.
And I think that was your response to the time too, which is what this conversation.
Okay. Well, it sounds like we have to start financially planning then.
There is possible legislation to include the REIT technology fee funding, the amount. I don't know if it's going to pass. It might lose its priority because the budget is such a big issue with the state this year.
Well, hopefully they'll give budget flexibility if they're not going to give money. You know, I mean, it's an easy way to help us without giving us cash, but who knows? Well, this is a good time.
Yeah, you can just kind of spend low-grade simmering anxiety on this one. So. Okay.
All right. Well, as long as everybody stays on the same page,
yeah,
that's great.
Yeah. Thanks. Yeah, Pastor. I would love it if there was something that was way better and that we could have access to at an affordable price. I'd be all for it.
Thanks, everybody. All right, next item is administration, and we're going to talk about the letters of support for the BEAD.
Oh, I was working on that.
Were you working on that?
I got interrupted. Nope. Only made it for me.
Hello, Cody. Thank you.
Good morning, commissioners.
Good morning.
Bakken, ARPA Broadband Coordinator. First, I'd like to say I'm not asking for money.
Oh, thank you. That's always good.
What?
I'm not asking for money.
Okay.
So I have presented in your packet the template for the letter of support for the BEAD applicants that are going to be working on, that are asking to work on the different project areas in Island County. To remind you, there are four project areas. They are essentially north would be through Coopville, south of Freeland through Clinton, and then the north half of Camino and the south half of Camino. So we have five ISPs that have expressed initial interest. Currently, I have responses back from 4 of those ISPs letting me know where they are planning to apply. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you that 3 of them are planning to put in for requests for funds from BEAD to do this initial round of applications.
You know, you and I talked about this. I'm sure you talked to my colleagues as well. And I'm so sorry it was a bad time for me to remember things and because family stuff. So, but what I'm recalling is that I was not feeling enthusiastic because they were kind of picking and choosing where they would be interested in serving, and that was going to possibly leave us with unserved areas still. Am I remembering that correctly? I may not be, Cody.
That was a possibility because we are getting very last minute notice. Mm-hmm. I mean, the applications for BEAD are not due until the 31st. And honestly, who turns in their application early? So, right. We're just trying to maintain our legislative process here at Island County, which means that we have certain deadlines in order to be able to submit a letter requested by an applicant for a specific area. So I am waiting for information, for solid information back from one of the ISPs, but I have prepared letters for them just in case, which can be added relatively short notice.
And why not North Whidbey? They have all the internet access they need up there, or we just didn't prioritize that because that's not where the votes were.
I'm sorry, I don't understand.
I want to know why Commissioner Sinclair didn't advocate for North Whidbey.
Why Zipley or whoever is not saying, oh, we want North Whidbey to be
part. We've had, I think, 2 of the applicants say that they are interested in North Whidbey through Coopville area. So they would be responsible for
from
that
the bridge
whole area.
Through Coopville?
Yes.
All the way? Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Because it sounded like we were talking about South Whidbey and Camino and, you know, mm-hmm. high voter areas for her. And she's the one leading this project. But the income inequity is on North Whidbey. So why, I want to understand why we're not talking more about North Whidbey, if that's where the equity conversation comes from.
So we don't have any control over who puts in an application.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's their costing. It's what they think would be best for their business, because we work with private sector partners on this. And some of them are just not well established enough near North Whidbey to be able to reasonably apply. One partner has said that they are not interested in applying for the initial round of funding. They have costed it out and they think that there might be a better opportunity later on. Mm-hmm. That's their choice.
When I look at this letter, it says, I'm pleased to express our strong support for blank. I would be pleased to express my strong support for applications that would cover North Whidbey, for applications that would cover the areas in Coopville that now the Port of Coopville is not going to be covering.
Mm-hmm.
Those areas, applications that are covering areas that really need them. Those are the ones that I want to express strong support. I will support everybody. You know, I am pleased to express our support. But if you're going to say that my support is strong, it's really, I would prefer that to be for those applications that are really intended to provide service that currently people do not have.
Well, first you need to change the I am to we are, because you have we Thank everywhere you. Else in yeah. the letter. And just, it's on behalf of the chair. So yeah. It's not fair to have her be the.
Okay.
So that just those two, but every That's place good. Else says we. Mm-hmm. So at least you can cover up and say it's the board's fault. I mean, we've talked about this. It's just the letter. I get it. It's just, it's fine.
So
we just have to, I mean, I,
If I'm understanding correctly, you would like me to make an edit to specific letters that are responding to the North would be through Coopville project area.
Right, those areas that really are in need. I mean, if someone wants to come and, you know, look for BEAD funding for an area that already's got three or four providers, okay, I support them in that. But my strong support is for people who want to provide service for people who don't have service right now or have really minimal service.
Now, the one of the things to understand about it's project number 120, but North would be through Coopville, is that it's a large amount of population that is not densely packed in. Oak Harbor would be the most dense area, and that has the least amount of locations that need be served. So in doing this project area, they're not really looking at Oak Harbor, except more as like a pass through.
Oh yeah, okay. Oak Harbor has service.
Right, okay. Well, I get that. I guess it's hard for me to visualize how North Whidbey isn't densely packed, but South Whidbey is. I mean, Melanie's district goes from the ferry dock all the way up to the drive-in to get as much population as my district does. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to understand how there's uniqueness in terms of the density of population. I mean, I'm kind of, it's fine. I don't want to give internet to people with second homes. They're not my priority. Mm-hmm. I mean, when we really started this conversation, it was about equity, a lot of it related to income equity. Mm-hmm. And we had kids out of school and people who didn't have internet, and that's what our primary concern was. And I just don't want it to switch to, well, this is what's affordable for the internet services to provide, because these are the people who can afford to pay for it. They just need access to it. And then we're subsidizing the ability of those people who could pay for it by giving them the access, when really what we were trying to do was get the access to the people who couldn't afford to install the access. That was like our primary motivation. And I just want to make sure we're not losing it.
No.
I mean, we need internet.
Right.
I'm in favor of the internet. I might be being snarky. I thought the 10 o'clock start would help me, but
our vision hasn't changed.
Yeah. All right. I'm fine.
Okay. I can make those small adjustments to the letters, and they will be in the packet for Tuesday.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah. Next item is Tony. Treasurer. I'm sorry, just Tony. No, it's Treasurer. Treasurer Tony Lamb.
Hi. Great to see you again.
Hey.
10 minutes earlier. So I think I was requested to be presenting every quarter instead of the monthly, and that's from last year. Am I to presume it's pretty falling to same?
I think so. Yeah. Really, what I was especially interested in today is just to know what the heck the results, the 2024 results of the treasurer, you know.
How long does it take you to get a previous quarter information? So do you have that in January or February?
No, I ran the reports every month, actually, because I it helps me as well to see where we're at month by month. And I do send these information to the board every month. It's just that I won't be here to ask you questions if you have any, that's all. Yeah.
No, quarterly, I think it's fine. Yeah. What do you think,
Joe? Yeah,
okay. I agree. But yeah, the treasurer's office is doing well. As mentioned before about the hiccup from last year regarding the PAC system. Yeah, the good thing is that we now have a great improved payment website for the taxpayers. Previously, it's harder for them to find that payment option. Right now it's easy, it's a quick link to go in there, and they can go ahead and do a payment card. They can make multiple properties at one payment rather than paying individually each property. They have 20 properties, 20 credit card payments, fees. So that's a huge improvement, and that started in last year of October.
You always want to make it as easy as possible for people to give you money.
But it did take us quite a bit to get there, in part because of the PAX thing, but we're there now, so that's good. I'm going to go over quickly the Treasurer's Month Report. Any questions, just let me know. Investment rates and balances as of December 31st. The ICT investment pool is at 2.81, a low drop from the previous month.
Tony.
Yes.
How much longer till we can get our money out of what it's in and that thing can start performing?
It is slowly. We're slowly improving right now as investments. Bonds that we purchased 2-3 years ago matures, we are purchasing at a higher, much higher interest rate. I believe later on you'll see.
The charge looks better. It's going up.
And I was at the market update webinar yesterday, and it looks like treasury bonds for future year, 5 years ahead, is improving greatly. I believe it was 6 months ago, I was looking at treasury bonds for 5 years. It was at 4%. Mm-hmm. Right now it's at 4.7%. I didn't realize that how huge a drop it, increase it was. Mm-hmm. But I am looking for trying to purchase more long-term. I've been keeping a bigger balance in the LJP because
it's doing better than our pool.
Right. but I still need to diversify our investment so that there is continual money coming in for 3-4 years from now or 5 years from now. So we can't just leave money in the pool. As soon as it drops down, we're going to be stuck looking for a replacement to where to invest it. So we try to make sure that there is money coming in the long run as well. But now that their 5 year is increasing, I would try and decrease the amount of money that's in the pool and slowly move it out there too. But definitely liquidity is always important so that we have to have money available so to cover all the costs, warrants and such. And there's surprisingly things that come up that I'm unaware of. So it's good to have a little pot in there in the LGIP.
The LGIP looks good. It's the pool that doesn't look good.
Right. The LGIP is slowly going down because the Fed rate is going down. So the LGIP is going down, but the investment pool is going up slowly though, as soon as old bond purchase that was made a while ago matures, we're going to go ahead and invest it in long-term better yield. And it there's a huge amount that is maturing this year.
Okay.
The bank balance, the county residual investment pool, we have 123 million, which is about 43% of our pool. The taxing district have 57% in the pool at 163 million. The total pool as of December 31st is 286 million. The money we kept in the Key Bank and Heritage Banks totals to 11 million. That is just to make sure that it covers any warrants outstanding as well as any wire transfer funds that we are expensing out every month. 24% of our investment pool is invested in the LGIP, and 48% is maturing within the 1 year. And that's what I was mentioning earlier, that there's a lot of these bonds that are purchased a while back. Once they mature, we're going to be reinvesting in the higher yielding interest bonds. Especially within the month of, I believe, March and June, there's quite a bit there. In July 2024, 2,000 districts issued bonds totaling 45 million, which they will expense within the year. And that is why there's such a huge amount in the LGIP. As of December 31st, the 2024 property tax levies for current expense, roads, and conservation futures were 97.83% collected. Comparable amount from 2023 was about 97.96%, so very similar. Foreclosure update. 2024 started with 118 properties subject to foreclosure. The 2024 certificate of delinquency was filed on August 5th. The final count of 10 properties were auctioned online on December 3rd. One property did not sell, so we re-auctioned on the 11th. Total 9 properties were sold and 1 will be transferred to tax title. We did notify the public works about this tax title property if they have any interest. And we did mention that if not, we might contact the Camino Island Mosquito Fleet if they have an interest about that.
So this is on Camino Island?
It's a tiny little parcel.
Is it big enough for a pickleball court?
I need you not know.
No, really.
Maybe not.
Serious. We're serious.
But it's between two properties. I'm not sure what the purpose of that lot is, but we'll check with the public works if or even the Camino Island Mosquito. Okay. The number of REIT affidavits processed in December was 272 compared to 217 in November, slight drop, and 268 in December, so it's comparable, similar. The county's portion of excise revenue was $326,000 in December on sale of $79 million. This REIT activity resulted in Island County year-to-date excise revenue of $39 million less than for the same period in 2023 and 0.9 less than in 2022, but 2.2 less than in 2021. Have any questions so far? I mean, this next chart that page number 2, it shows the comparable interest rate earnings for the different treasury bonds, as well as the LJP and the ICTIP, the Ison County Treasury Pool. A lot of the bonds out there, treasury bonds, are going down, including the LJP. The treasury pool is going up, but progressively up. And hopefully we'll be going further up by the end of this year. The next page 3, we have a list of the participants in the Island County Treasury Pool. The largest participant is, of course, Island County, as well as Island Transit with $60 million in there. And page 4, we have the year-to-date investment interest earnings. We projected a budget of $2.4 million in earnings. We have $3 million in investment earnings. A part of that is because we were not speculating, but we're, a lot of the markets, bond holders and such on, were mentioning that the federal interest rate would be dropping in the middle of the year and not as a bit as what happened was that it's dropped slowly in the last quarter only. So the interest rate was remaining high. So we earned a lot of interest there. Page 5 is just a brief recap of the pool itself, the interest rate, participants, the bond issuers. Page 6 shows the Island County portion of REIT excise. I believe it was County Administrator Michael Jones that put a budget of expectation of revenue of $4 million. And it seems like he's perfectly right. It's about $4 million, a little over $4 million, actually.
Good.
And page 7 just does a little comparison of the number of affidavits processed by month. We don't have much control over this, but it's good to see where we are at. And it looks like we are slowly dropping from the previous 2021 and 2020. And but it's comparable to last year though, similar. Page 7 just shows the excise revenue in a for our tribe.
Okay.
Do you have any questions regarding the charts or information?
No, I think our first quarterly report of this year will be an important one.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But if you have any questions, do give me a call or email or yeah. And I know that I'm here quarterly, but I do send these out monthly. So any questions? Thank you.
Yeah. Thank Good you, job, Tony.
All right.
Tony the treasurer.
Tony the treasurer. And we have human services with us this morning.
Oh.
The housing update.
I'm ready.
And Commissioner Johnson is ready.
Well, it's going to be a hard one. I wrote down that it's going to be a hard one.
Very distressing.
Good morning.
Good morning. You sound awful peppy for what's going to be a hard conversation.
Informational at this point.
Okay.
Before I forget, we just learned that there's a property on Camino Island. You guys look at that and see if we can put affordable housing why we're pushing to try to sell it when maybe we need it. We don't know.
It's from Tony. Should I talk to Tony?
Yeah. Okay. Maybe a pickleball court, maybe a affordable housing.
Maybe it perks and we could do a offsite septic.
Yeah, exactly. There's so many things we actually need properties.
Okay.
But you don't need to do it.
Put George septic. Right on that.
George.
Okay.
Linda Austin, Director of Human Services, with Emily Wildman, who is our housing program manager. And Emily's going to lead this discussion. She's got a PowerPoint for us.
Hi, commissioners. So today we're going to talk about the coming year. It's a big year, obviously. We have changes in leadership and both at the state and federal level, and then which will impact housing. And specifically in housing, we're going to be talking about this year's 5-year homeless housing plan and how that ties into the comprehensive plan. We're going to be talking about current funding projections for 2025 and some changing guidelines coming from the state consolidated homeless grant. So first up, we'll talk about the homeless housing plan. So this housing plan will run from 2025 to 2030. We're at the end of our last homeless housing plan. And the state has released their plan. They released their plan in October. And now counties are mandated with creating their own local plans. And they have released a plan guidance. And so we're going to talk about some of the components of that and the objectives that the state established that the counties need to implement also. So some of the components are that they need to be, this plan needs to be aligned with other planning. So for example, we need to align with our local comprehensive plan, the housing element. We will need to take the same estimates that are used in that plan for what's needed in the community around permanent supportive housing and emergency housing needs. We will be working closely with the planning department to make sure that those things align. There's plans to work together, maybe have some co-shared meetings around the housing element, and then they'll be invited to our homeless housing plan task force as we have been invited to participate in their planning around the housing element.
Does every jurisdiction do their own plan?
Yes, every county. And cities may also choose to do their own plan.
That's what I was asking. Are they required to, or they can opt in or out?
Correct. They can opt in or out. And those discussions have not happened yet. This is kind of the first step in this plan. So I will be going to the cities to check in to see if they want to write their own plan. My guess would be no, but I will certainly check in and see.
If they don't, we write the plan for them?
Yes. So this plan will also look at current local plan, current service levels that we already have. So we'll be looking at our current crisis response system, so our current emergency shelters and transitional housing. It'll be looking at our current fund sources, both ones that we're utilizing and potential fund sources, to report on where we're at now and where we're moving towards.
I think this explains what you were explaining earlier. I think you answered this question, but so in the comp plan, with the allocation of incomes towards certain areas, you're working with planning because some of those jurisdictions are required to have things like shelters and income eligible housing for certain ranges of income. So that's what you're working with planning on a lot, is making sure that our plan is supportive of where we have allocated populations within that plan.
Exactly. And it's going to be mostly, it will be focused on the part of the housing element that is 30% AMI and below, permanent supportive housing, and the emergency shelter allotments. So it'll be kind of a plan for that very narrow scope of the community, which is a lot of people, but is a very specific population. And then the state also wants to see the any sort of capital development that's happening in communities. They want to see that it will align with the Growth Management Act and align with our local comprehensive plan. And then they want to see how communities will determine that. So we'll also be working on a prioritization around what capital projects will be funded through the funding sources that we have control over.
So that'd be like building new housing.
Yes, with like 1590 funds and what will be funding around like emergency shelter. It wouldn't be, it would not include like the housing trust fund, which is not under our control. And then the state identified 5 objectives that the community needs to adopt. And then within those objectives, that's how you make it more specific to your community. So the first objective is to promote an equitable, accountable, and transparent homeless crisis response system. In the last plan, there was a lot of focus on racial disparity and how we look at that and tools that were developed. And so now the focus will be on taking the tools that have been established by the state and continually kind of monitoring that and making sure that we're serving vulnerable communities and that we're addressing any racial disparities that are happening in the services that we provide locally. The second objective is to strengthen the homeless service provider workforce. So Commerce is advocating for, you know, more pay, stronger trainings. The pay part is easier said than done, given that there's not extra funding to do that. But
yeah.
I will say that Commerce has already started providing more online trainings
okay.
that we're able to pass on. So that's been really good. And it, you know, it obviously makes sense. We can provide more effective services if our workforce is well paid and well trained. So it's a great goal to have. It just can be harder to implement. And we cannot mandate what our providers pay.
Mm-hmm.
We can encourage them to pay, you know, at living wages, but mm-hmm. it is ultimately up to our providers what they pay.
Now, I have a question here. So this is our homeless housing plan.
Correct.
But we're talking about service providers, which to me seems different than a housing plan.
So the housing plan is what the comprehensive plan has. So that's addressing housing from emergencies.
Someone's going to sleep.
Right. When, and this is also addressing that. This is addressing, so that plan addresses everything from emergency shelter all the way up to 100, right. you know, plus AMI. This is specifically looking at the emergency shelters, the permanent supportive housing, and 30% AMI and below. So 30% AMI and below is not necessarily going to have a service provider workforce, but the permanent supportive housing and the emergency shelter will have that.
But I think it's because I defined it different. So service provider isn't Spin Cafe. Service provider is somebody who is providing housing or stabilizing somebody in actual housing. It's not service that's not associated with housing.
There are, in the plan, there is generally, it will include things like SPIN. That is not the main focus. The main focus is actually to get people housed, but part of that does include day service type of things, local resources, food banks, all of that is, those people will be invited to participate in the plan because they are part of the crisis response system. But this plan is to target housing, homeless housing, but it is also going to include services for people who are unhoused on their pathway to hopefully getting housed. Does that make sense?
It does. I mean, I'm resisting the urge to rename the plan, but it's not. Well, because it's basically like a homeless housing and crisis response plan.
Yes.
It's not just our plan to provide housing. It's not specific to that. It's really that full continuum from a person on the street in crisis to stably housed to people who are working who need income eligible housing. So correct. It's that full continuum up until 30% AMI.
Correct.
From crisis to 30%.
Correct.
This is the plan for that entire population, housing and service.
Correct.
Okay. All right. I was too limited there.
Homeless housing crisis response really should be the name of it.
It really
should. Because that's what we do.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you. Okay. I know I'm not renaming it, but now I feel better.
The third objective is to prevent episodes of homelessness whenever possible. This is a big change from years past. Before COVID, there was a lot of focus on people who are chronically homeless and getting people who are unhoused housed. And the thought was that people who needed preventative services such as rental assistance, that the majority of those people would self-solve. They'll figure it out. They have more resources. That has really shifted since the pandemic with rents high, deposits high, and the lack of affordable housing. So the state has included this objective because prevention is really a much bigger focus. They've added the eviction prevention money, which is a much larger pot of money for rental assistance than we had prior to COVID. And they've just recognized that population of people can't self-solve anymore. There's just not enough resources. So there has to be resources put out there to help prevent people from falling into homelessness as we see evictions on the rise, mm-hmm. rents on the rise, and all of that. The fourth objective is to prioritize assistance based on the greatest barriers to housing stability and the greatest risk of harm. And this is really about having a strong vulnerability tool to determine who is the highest vulnerability to falling into homelessness or who is, their safety is at risk by being unhoused. And so it is to help establish who basically gets the next permanent supportive housing emergency shelter spot. And the state is also working on a vulnerability tool because there's never been a consistent one across the state. Every community has used their own. We have one that we use and we are working to improve that. And then the last objective is to seek to house everyone in a stable setting that meets their needs. And this really is the objective that ties the strongest into the housing element because as we improve and create housing in all aspects from emergency shelter to 100% AMI and above, that allows people to have more choice in what is best for them. Right now, we're kind of at we have this, take it or leave it, because this is all we have. Mm-hmm. And we hope to get to a point where people have more ability to say, I feel like this is the best next step for me. I want permanent supportive housing, or I'm ready for permanent housing without the supportive services. So people should have a right to say what they feel their best need is. We can't always meet that, and sometimes it's not realistic, but it is always good to have options for people. The more they buy into things, the more people are likely to be successful in their housing.
Want me just not swing at that pitch and let it go?
You can certainly
welcome your feedback.
I hear you. I understand what you're saying from the dignity lens of the person. I also hear the community. And if you're coming and you're getting free housing or subsidized housing or government given housing, you're going to take what you get. You get choice when you can pay for your choices. You get choice when you are able to be self-sufficient to have your choices, but you don't get to just ask the government and then sit there and say, I want free will and I don't like what you're offering. You're going to get what you get. And I think that I understand. But that is such a, I literally can't even process that conversation. You know what I would like to do? I would like to live in a mansion. I'd like to have a swimming pool and a sauna. I'd also like to have a maid. You know what I don't have? Any of those things. Why? Because I can't afford those things. So I don't get those things. I don't get what I choose. I get what I can have. And I don't want a mentality of people who are like, well, I want something else. Well, you're going to get what you get until you can earn something else.
Let me give you an example. I don't think I explained it very well. Let's say you're a senior on a fixed income and I don't have any housing that's available in the 30% and under, and I only have emergency shelter.
Yeah.
And you don't want to go into emergency shelter. You want to be permanently housed. The idea would be eventually we could get to that point where we would have that to offer, or maybe somebody has fallen into homelessness and they need some permanent supportive housing to provide some wraparound services, but then maybe they're ready to move out of that. But at this point, we don't have permanent supportive housing, nor do we have something for them to move into without waiting for 5 to 10 years. So it's providing a better continuum to meet the needs of people.
Based on what their need is, not based on what their choice is. It's having housing appropriate for where the person is, not necessarily based on what they want.
Yeah, and it can also be like a region, like oftentimes now we can only offer somebody something in Oak Harbor, and maybe they've lived their whole life on the South End.
Right.
And we would like to provide more options. Like if you want to stay on the South End, we'd like you to be able to stay on the South End versus, and some people never want to leave Oak Harbor, but if we only have something open in the South, it's a bigger.
That seems different to me than choice. Okay.
Okay.
All right. Okay.
Good clarification though.
Yes. Thank you.
I mean, I heard that, how my town will hear that, and that's not going to go well.
Yeah.
It's just not. And I'm pretty nice. And I flipped out.
So any questions about the 5-year homeless housing plan before I move on to funding?
So this is the state's, this is Commerce's, worked out, this is from Commerce.
Yes, and it's a requirement that all counties complete this. And
it's due in December of 2025.
Oh. Okay.
Well, perfect, because we're not working on anything else.
No.
That's due.
No.
Okay.
There's lots of technical assistance provided by this, by Commerce. There have been many, many meetings around this.
There'll be many more.
There'll be many more. So it feels like an additional job that our department has been assigned.
Is. Yeah, no, it is.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to acknowledge the workload that our housing team is taking under.
But you're doing it with community outreach and community groups.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So there'll be a regular task force that meets, and we'll invite all, people from all over the community to participate.
Okay. And we're going to review the task force list.
Certainly. We're open to suggestions. So First of all, I'm going to talk about the local funding, the local document recording fees that you know, stay local. And these are fees that are collected on real estate transactions, as you guys are aware. Mm-hmm. And so we are facing a major shortfall in our document recording fees. Prior to COVID, we earned about $800,000 in document recording fees that stayed local to fund our homeless housing and service providers. At the peak of them in 2021, when mortgage rates were very low, we were at over $1 million. And this year, we just looked and the funds for 2024 were finalized. And so it's $447,000. So we are in kind of dire straits with our local document reporting fees. And it's the same with the Affordable Housing Fund. It started, you know, at its peak, it was $176,000. And now we're at less than half at $83,000. So I just wanted to bring this to your attention because this could lead to some very difficult decisions we'll need to make later this year when we put out an RFP for our homeless housing and our homeless housing service providers, who to fund, what to fund, because in the past we've put out about $700,000 and this year we will be unable to do that. At this with what has been brought in this year. So, and then on top of that, I want to talk about the state projections. So part of the local document recording fees stay local and we put the guidelines on those. And then the other go to the state, they take their chunk out, they put their guidelines on it, and then they send it to us. And that's the consolidated homeless grant. And the state has told us to prepare for a 20% cut in the consolidated homeless grant. That is a 2-year grant. And so we're looking at just under $700,000 less that we'll be receiving for our homeless housing services. So as you can see, we were just under $3.5 million the last one, and now we're going to be potentially looking at $2.7 million. Nothing is set in stone, but this is the first time that the state has asked us to prepare for a cut. So we want to be thinking about this and talking about this up front so that nobody is surprised by this. We should be getting some initial funding estimates from the state this month sometime, but it will not be finalized until April when the legislature is done.
Can we see a list of the things we've been funding mm-hmm. at the dollar amount?
Mm-hmm.
Just so I can mentally prepare for who's impacted. And I mean, I don't know that I want to like recommend a 20% cut just across the board to everybody. I think we'll probably want to be
more strategic.
I mean, I'm sure you feel the same way. Strategic about some people may get full funding, other people may get bigger cuts.
And this consolidated homeless grant does fund salaries that are within our department. And we have not hired a position that was vacated last summer, just in anticipation of all of this. So there has been some attrition already. We're pretty bare bones right now, though. So,
okay. I mean, that was smart.
Mm-hmm.
But,
yeah.
Okay.
So then, on top of the cuts, the Commerce is also working on new guidelines for their consolidated homeless grant. So I wanted to talk a little bit about those because there is some push and pull with what they're recommending, what we're doing, and kind of how we would like to see it. And, you know, certainly want to get your recommendations as we move closer. So these guideline changes would potentially start in July. So they want to increase monitoring requirements, which is wonderful. That means we're going to be overseeing our subgrantees more. But again, with less funding, the position that we don't have anymore would have been doing that. So it is a challenge. Commerce's recommendations is that there not be a limit on the length of time and the total rent assistance. So their position is that you find the most vulnerable people in your community and you pay their rent indefinitely until they either are able to pay it, they get into subsidized housing, they get in Section 8. So their idea is you find, for example, the top 20 most vulnerable people in your community and you serve them until they don't need it. And then everybody else, you don't serve. They go on a waiting list for when somebody maybe falls off, you know, is able to get into one of those options.
So the housing plan objectives that they stated said prioritize assistance based on the greatest barriers to housing stability and greatest risks of harm. So if you help 10 people completely, how are you going to meet that need of prioritizing people based on the greatest risk or the housing stability? You're not going to be able to help keep somebody in their home in the short term if they're having like a medical financial problem or they lost their job, or you're not going to be able to meet that goal and prioritize the 10 people who you're giving complete housing assistance to at unlimited dollar amounts for an unlimited period of time. You can't achieve both of those.
We agree, and that's why we haven't been, this has been, they've been talking about this now for a couple of years and we have kind of resisted because we feel the same way, that we would rather help more people who have different types of vulnerabilities than just find the most vulnerable and assist them indefinitely. It's more work. We screen people every month. But it is, to us, it's worth it because it does serve people in different types of vulnerabilities.
Okay. Okay. So I'm understanding that there's a conflict between those two values.
Mm-hmm. And then the other big change is that they would like 80% of the consolidated homeless grant to fund projects that are low barrier. And so those things would include like not being able to keep people out of our housing that have, you know, criminal background or active substance abuse, which works for some programs, but it currently would not work for some of our programs.
Mm-hmm.
For example, like House of Hope, which is a shared living situation.
Mm-hmm.
They do background checks. They do drug testing because there is a mix of people there.
Mm-hmm.
So if they were to be funded by this, they would not be able to do that any longer. And then the other one, which is, it's very controversial, is that you cannot exit people due to lack of engagement. And so it is very challenging at times to move people on. They've really gotten away from like you, when I first started, it was 90 days. It was pretty hard, you know, and they've really gotten away from that. They don't want people exit into homelessness. They want them to stay until we can meet their needs. But it is challenging when you don't have an engagement priority. So those are the things that we're kind of grappling with.
Well, I feel like I'm just one. First of all, no. I feel like there should be expectations placed on individuals who are participating in programs. I'm in favor of, you know, I don't think criminal background check should be a barrier to getting housing solely. Mm-hmm. I don't think solely alone it should be a barrier. I'm not sure that substance abuse should solely be a barrier given what it is. So I understand that. But lack of engagement is to me unacceptable because there is an expectation that you are working to improve your situation. And it's not that you just get housing, you live how you want, you do what you want, you don't engage in improvement. I feel that from a societal standpoint, we want to be helpful, but there should be expectations of behaviors. So I think that Island County should just be a strong no on that. You will engage. You will participate in programs improvements, and you'll meet the standards assigned to you if you're going to live in that environment. Or you are choosing to be homeless. You're choosing that because you're not modifying your behavior to meet the standards. Just like I choose to not go to jail by not breaking the law. I choose to keep my job by not, like, you know, behaving in unethical ways. I choose good behavior to get good outcomes. I have an absolutely no on lack of engagement.
And we do have, like, for example, the Haven is a low barrier project, and we don't require engagement. So that is a very appropriate low barrier, but it becomes much harder when you have, like, a Margie's House,
but
a Harbor Inn.
But that's not necessarily true with the Haven, because they do have expectations and they do remove people.
For behaviors.
Right.
Yeah. So, and that's not what that's saying. You can't insult somebody and, you know, or, but it is, they don't have to participate in any sort of case management at the Haven. They're offered services. They're not going to be turned away if they don't.
So I just don't care for that at all. What level of auditing will the state place on us with regard to ensuring that we are complying with these expectations?
Their current process is that they will monitor, like they do an online kind of monitoring where we send them guidelines, rules, and we send some of the client records, and we send that to them. They monitor and say, yes, you're low barrier, doing great, or no, you're not. It's not been an issue because the Haven is currently operating as low barrier. They've only done one monitoring of that since I've been here, mm-hmm. and it was just this year. So I think they're, or just in 2024. So I think they're gearing up to maybe be doing more of that. And then it also goes along with the monitoring that they're going to require that we do with their subgrantee. So I don't have an exact answer yet because I don't know that they know. But my guess is from the past, they'll do a monitoring. If you're not doing it the way they want, then they'll provide you with technical assistance. If you then shift and fall into what they would like, then you're good. If you don't, then you'll get more technical assistance. And then potentially it could lead to them saying, we're not going to fund you in the future if this doesn't change.
So I suppose what we do is we do it the way it makes most sense to us, and then we wait for them to offer us technical assistance if they're unhappy with our
And this processes. Is just for the state funding, which obviously is much more than our local funding.
Yeah.
So we have some flexibility in how we structure who gets, who is funded by what.
Right.
However, you know, this is going to impact,
of course,
our programs.
Am I wrong about this? I mean, I'm now caught up in college philosophy over here.
No, most people would agree with what you're saying around the engagement.
Like, this is like a contract with society, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you're getting public dollars. People are paying their tax dollars in because there's a value that we want to care for others. We understand the most vulnerable in this country. We don't like to see people hurting. We're willing to do, we want to care for our neighbors. But that isn't, there's a social contract in that, right? Okay. I'm not wrong. This isn't one of those things I have to think about more.
I think the idea, the like philosophical idea, is that some people need different amounts of time to engage. And so some people will engage right away. Some it will take a much longer amount of time. And that is what I think they're going for. It is much more challenging to actually implement that because we have limited services. And if this person is ready to engage, and I can't put them in shelter because this person is choosing not to engage yet, or that's not right. ready to engage yet, you have a very hard position.
Yeah, I would be totally in favor of this if we had unlimited funds or even
unlimited resources. for places to stay.
It's because of our situation, we're going to have to pick and choose who gets what.
Mm-hmm.
And this makes it be really problematic.
And this is designed, again, for a larger community.
An urban area.
So I basically just wanted to kind of bring this to you guys' attention so that you can be aware of what Commerce is asking for in the future. Any other questions?
I don't have a question about this. So do you have any questions about this, Jill?
No.
My thoughts
a lot of my thoughts lately have been about all the people who have lost their homes in California. All the people lost their homes. There's people who are not going to be able to build again because their home was on the beach. And I don't think California's going to let you build another house on the beach.
I would hope not.
There's going to be a lot of people who are going to be looking at Washington State to move to. And Oregon is going to have the same problem.
That's fine. Mm-hmm.
Oregon, but we're going to have that problem. And so we're going to have, there's going to be a lot of people with a lot of money are going to want to move here. This is going to really impact our comp plan and what we're going to have to do. I don't know how much it's going to impact affordable housing, except insofar as it could potentially increase the property values that are already too high. I think. Just generally speaking, make it even more difficult for people to be able to afford housing here. So that's, I'm looking months down the road here, but I think that this is a very, very real thing that the state's going to have to be paying attention to and that we are going to be paying attention to in our comp plan.
I agree. I mean, we had a gentleman that I remember very vividly that was a victim of the Paradise Fire who ended up staying with a relative up here and got kicked out and entered our, you know, homeless system because he had nowhere to go and there was no going back to California. Yeah. And that, you know, that's kind of different, but it's not in the same kind of category.
It's the very same thing. Mm-hmm. You come up here because, I mean, you're talking about people who can afford to come up here, but some people may have family connections up here.
That's right.
This is where they'll refuge, right?
Yeah.
And then that always sounds like a good idea until you had somebody who's living in your house for 6 months, and then that's less of a good idea. And then you end up with people with no resources who are trying to figure out how to relocate in a community that doesn't have affordable housing for them or options for them. And we'll all end up trying to find solutions because that's just how that will happen.
I talked to a mortgage banker on Monday about prices of lumber already going up after these fires, prices of construction materials all over rising, and this very issue of relocation and what that's going to do to our community in particular.
Yeah, the West, I just talked to Ryan about this because of the jail. I was like, oh my God, the jail. But it's not good, the prices won't go down. But the West Coast, all of the West Coast is going to, I mean, anybody who wants to build, you want to get nails, you want to get lumber, you want a construction crew. If you are a hustling construction company, you're moving your business down there.
Yeah.
I mean, the entire West Coast economy is going to be impacted by this.
Yeah.
And then you get all the Californians up here, which in and of itself is an impact.
Yeah.
Because you know how I like it, out of towners. No, really. No, you're right. We don't even understand the magnitude of what just happened.
Right.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah. But we will be impacted.
Mm-hmm. Well, so are you planning to make this presentation to the different municipalities or what is the, or you're talking to us or what kind of is the, what's the approach to let people know what Commerce is requiring of us to consider? So this doesn't feel like an arbitrary, well, the county's doing blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
How are we letting people know that we're receiving kind of parameters and direction? And we're going to need everybody to work together within those parameters and direction. How are we getting that?
Yeah, I think the next step would be contacting the local municipalities to check in about whether they're wanting to do a homeless housing plan, kind of letting them know what the resources are, and then inviting them, if they don't want to do their own plan, to participate, and where we'll be, you know, discussing all of this and presenting this to them.
Maybe we should do this at the COG.
And the
expectations. Yeah, so when are they going to be at COG, Megan? When is Human Services at COG?
They are in February 22nd.
Yeah. So we can do this presentation then?
Yeah, we were going to do it on emergency shelter, but we could kind of tie it all together.
I just want them to understand expectations.
Yes.
Right? Like, this is what these requirements are, because I do think sometimes there's some one, lack of understanding of the rules, two, a belief that we set all the parameters ourselves,
right?
And then especially with funding cuts, it's easy for there to be community rhetoric about mismanagement of our funds, and it needs to be very clear that the funding that's flowing in, that we flow out, is less. So, I mean, we can't put out more water than you take in, right?
Right.
Okay, I think it's important for everybody to understand where some of the direction's coming from.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
And then you think we'll start prioritizing when we know the numbers in terms yes. of like the.
Well, and what'll happen is we'll do this, put out this request for proposals, and that's where the real prioritization will.
Right. Come. We have the Housing Advisory Board have a subcommittee that will look at all the applications, and we'll grade those, and we'll talk about their priority recommendations, which will then be brought to you all to talk about your priorities.
So I would probably propose swapping that to make sure that we are clear on what the board priorities are, and then give the advisory committee some parameters to make decisions. Because if they're making recommendations and they come to us and we're like, these are not in alignment at all.
Okay.
Then we're going to have a tension. So I think if we're saying whatever we're going to say, I can't even pick. But if we're saying we're going to stabilize seniors and seniors are our highest priority, if we say that, then that's the lens that we need to look through. Or if we're saying we want to take a shotgun approach, then that's the lens that we're looking through. Or if we're targeting specific community needs, and we would want to talk with you guys about what that means as we set up those parameters, but I don't want to give the advisory group just open-ended parameters.
I think personally. It probably makes sense once we have more concrete figures
yeah.
before we put out the RFP, because we could include the community, the commissioner's priorities in the RFP so that people know mm-hmm. what they're working with.
Because like my knee-jerk reaction is nothing new. Right. Like sure. My first thing is, if you're starting something new, you don't have the ability to sustain existing services. So like, but that's like knee jerk. I don't know what I'm really saying there, right. What that means. But some of those types of things where if we say you have to have been serving these populations for the last 5 years or something, I mean, mm-hmm. or we only want to see X percentage go to administration. Like, I'm kind of like, look, this has to be direct. Our money has to be direct service. I don't want it sucked up in admin, for example. Right? Like, okay. I don't know. I mean, I'm just saying, I don't know what I'm saying. I don't want people to freak out. But that's kind of like what I'm thinking, is that we're given some, we're able to give a little guidance on where we want to see this money end up.
Like, I know of, I've heard in meetings, there have been counties who have suggested such things as, we are going to prioritize long-term shelter over emergency night-to-night shelter.
Mm. Right.
Okay. So those kind of broader distinctions.
Right. Yeah. Rather than population specific, mm-hmm.
housing type specific.
Okay. Our 1590 funds, our mm-hmm. self-tax dollars. So how much do we get in that every year? Have we been getting?
The 1590 funds are the 0.1%. Yeah. So I think about a million.
About a million. Yeah. I'm just concerned because we've lost our document. So much of it now are document funds. I'm wondering, Commissioner, and maybe it's not even legal to use a portion of that, a percentage of that, for a crisis response.
Well, there's another affordable housing fund. We call it the 1406. It's the tax rebate that we do have more flexibility on than the 1590, and we did put $200,000 of that in our budget for rental assistance for 2025. Mm-hmm. But the 1590 is is more targeted.
Pretty targeted.
Mm-hmm. For actual building and yeah. new construction and new acquisition of affordable housing for specific targeted populations.
It has some operations, but I believe it's very targeted to like mental health stabilization, permanent. It may have
permanent
some
supportive housing.
Permanent supportive housing
operation, possibly.
I don't want to complicate it, but I'm just trying to think through, like, every county is having this exact same mm-hmm. conversation.
Yes.
Right. So if every county picked the exact same part of the continuum,
mm-hmm.
then we leave people out. Right. Mm-hmm. So are there, and again, I can hear every county being like, that's not our job.
Right.
But I mean, I can't, like, I can just imagine other commissioners like, that's a great job for Island County. But is there any value in coordinating these plans in a way that says, okay, these communities are better suited for long-term shelters. These counties have communities that are better suited for long-term shelters. These counties are better able to provide permanent supportive housing because they have workforces. These are better suited for, I mean, because not everybody's going to be able to pick everything to fund and do.
Right.
Is there any strategy around which, like, I keep thinking in our region, right? Because our behavioral health region's the five counties. Is there any logic or reasoning or value to saying, look, you need emergency shelter. Those are best provided in Snohomish. And you need longer term housing, and that's best provided in these other counties, but that there's more of a regional housing partnership. Or like permanent supportive housing will always be hard for us because of workforce, for example, if we need it, but we may not be the best county that should have lots of it because there's more workforce on the I-5 corridor. And so should more of those types of projects be other places in our region, or they really want you to be county specific?
Currently, it's really set up to be county specific. I mean, we could try and partner with other counties.
I mean, and we do refer to other counties all the time.
Right.
I think the biggest issue is that everybody at this point is overloaded in all the categories. And mm-hmm. so it's not been looked at in a regional way, at least not in the last 8 years.
Some of this is just because we know, like, when Skagit shuts down their overnight shelter, they're like, well, Island County has one, or they have a list of places that have it. Well, if they choose to lean into another part of their continuum or prioritize their spending on another part of their continuum, that does then shift that population to us or to other types of communities. And so it's like, well, you know, I'm not sure that that is the best population for our community to be serving because we don't have as many outpatient resources. We don't have as many services here. So is that a conversation that gets linked up again with like the behavioral health to say these types of housing solutions need to be near service investments also? Or we've got to tell our neighbors, you're going to have to figure out how to fund all these things because we're not your safety net. We're the smaller county.
I mean, currently, counties can prioritize their own residents. So that would need to go away if you were going to take a more regional approach.
We can prioritize residents?
Mm-hmm.
Well,
yeah.
I just don't like the fact that some counties are choosing to invest in other things, and then that leaves people who are at the lower end of the continuum scrambling for options, right when we don't have enough options for our own people.
Mm-hmm. But like Linda said, we do refer people elsewhere if we don't have what they what they need. Right. So
okay
well,
just one other quick thing. 2 weeks from tomorrow is the point in time count. So just to have that on your radar, I'll send out an email, but it's the annual event.
I'm not allowed.
Right, she's not allowed.
Only for information.
Information.
Not looking for volunteers.
Okay. No. I'm happy to go, but you'll end up with someone that you're going to have to walk with for until we get them figured out. So.
And we're not using as many just general community volunteers. We're working really with our agencies and with our staff is all doing the work. Because
how come we change that?
Because the acuity of the people, the danger level of the encampments, it's not really appropriate to send out general community members out there. So we utilize our teams more. There is a larger volunteer group on the south end. I think they're involved a lot with Rotary and stuff. And so, but again, it's more event focused. The people who are actually out in the community, it is tends to be more the people who have relationships or familiarity with that, just for safety reasons.
That's sad. That's changed a lot.
Mm-hmm. That's too small. All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Everybody.
This wasn't as hard as I wrote on my calendar.
Oh, good.
I wrote hard meeting on my calendar.
All right, then. If there's nothing more, I don't have any kind of special things on here, so meeting's adjourned.
Great.